Hello, hello, and hello, everybody. Welcome back for another episode, If Not Now When. In today's show, it is so special. I am really excited to welcome Jimmy Ramirez to join us today. And Jimmy, you might remember, he is a partner of Matt that we met last week. He's another partner for PGP, a private equity fund that supports early stage founder, and Bavamar, a Texas-based residential and commercial development company. Jimmy, however, focused on legal, construction development, investor relationship, cost management, and real estate project valuation. Also, he had an incredible personal story of how he achieved all the incredible, amazing things. So without further ado, my friend, please join me to welcome Jimmy to the show. Well, Jimmy, welcome and welcome. Thank you so much. Come all the way from Houston to come visit us. I am so excited to have you today on the show.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to, talk about my journey and,
yes,
for you to get to know me and get it out there.
I love it. So tell us, how does all the journey begin for you, Jimmy?
So I grew up in a town called, South Texas, McAllen.
Nice.
It's very South Texas, close to South Padre Island, where SpaceX is at. That's where everybody kind of knows is at now. I was there probably since I was 8 years old.
Mm.
Before that, we were kind of moving around between Houston and California. My mom was a single, parent raising me. She was an immigrant from Mexico.
Oh, wow.
Essentially, I was, just following her everywhere, right? I was a child. So moving schools a lot.
Was it difficult for you?
It was. I was, having to make friends and trying to figure myself out. I realized I couldn't get too comfortable anywhere. So learning how to adapt was kind of one of my strengths that I've gained from growing up that way. Meeting different types of people and like being able to read them and things like that, like who I can get along with, who I can't and why not, like what are the underlying issues that are going on between them and things like that. But yeah, it was difficult, but I think it was advantageous at the end.
Okay. So what happened next?
So essentially, we set ground in McAllen, Edinburgh area, and we were living there. My mom was waiting tables. I went to four different elementaries, from pre-K to fifth grade. Moving to Edinburgh when I went to middle school and high school, and that's when I started getting into sports. Middle school, I was okay. I was better at track and field and soccer and things like that. But when I got to high school, I was very good at football. I got my growth spurt, I was able to be a three-year letterman in football, and I was born with an undeveloped left hand called cimbrocadactyl. And I was starting to get very publicized with my sports and football and things like that. So I was coming out on the news, and it's a small town, right? And I kind of grew up with my friends from middle school to high school, and I would kind of crutch to my sports. Like that's what would kind of keep me, motivated and going. And, I was naturally good at school. The way I would make friends is kind of letting them copy off of me. So I would just be really good at school and just focus on sports, work out a lot, and be really good. And eventually,
How do you play sports if you have the natural limitation?
Yeah, I was a lot of diligence, and I had amazing coaches. I want to give a shout out to Coach Salas. So he did like very specific trainings with me, like catching tennis balls, going from like 30, 40, 50, 60 miles an hour, and
wow,
like catching, because if you can catch a tennis ball, you can catch a football, right? Like it's a wider, ball. And, I started.
That's a lot of resilience.
Yeah, it needed a lot, right? I wasn't that good at the beginning, but once you just keep going, and that's kind of like what I've put into, business now, right? Like, don't give up. Like, you might be at your last little hurdle. Like, don't give it up. So that's what was going on with me. And, I was amazing at football, scoring all the time, like how to get double teamed all the time. Quarterbacks were respecting me, things like that. And I was really good in track too. I was good at, the 200-meter dash, 400-meter dash.
And what happened next? Well, you want to be a playing sport professionally at the time?
So I was going to redshirt at UTSA. I talked to the coach at the time, Coach Coker, and It was amazing. It was an amazing program. I love the coach a lot. And I started talking to him and he's like, you have the skills, you have the speed, you have the agility. And he told me like, are you ready to get like very publicized? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, you know how you publicized, you know, in high school, like how, you know, you have news, the newspapers and just social media and things like that. I was like, I'm not. Like, I don't think I want to be known for sports and like people having pity or anything like that. I want to be known.
What do you mean by that?
I wanted to be more known for like my brain more than like, hey, like, you know, this guy's really good at sports and, you know, he has the undevelopment, you know, disadvantage, but he's really good at sports. But I don't want to be known or like publicized for that. I wanted to be known more for business and intelligence and things like that. So I went a different route. So I was like, you know what, like, I'm going to quit this and I'm going to focus on my career.
Was it the hard choice?
It was a very hard choice, especially when I was using that as a crutch.
Yeah.
But, you know, thankfully, I went to an amazing school where I met a lot of good friends. And I joined a fraternity who welcomed me with open arms. And that's when I started getting really close to friends and veering some off. And, like, you know, I guess once I started getting, like, really good internships, you know, when I focused on my major and figuring out what I was going to do after college. Like, I kind of already had an idea because I graduated high school at 17 and graduated college at 20. So it was really fast.
Wait, college in a year?
3 years.
Oh, 3 years.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
3 years. Yeah. Okay. So I was moving at a really fast pace. So I didn't really get to grow up and enjoy like my young life too much because, you know, stepping it back a bit. When I was in high school, I was working as like a backhoe driver at this quarry that was family owned, and I would load up, you know, 18 wheelers for 8 to 10 hours, you know, just to make some money and support my family as much as I could. And my mom was working all day, so I was always by myself. So I was known as the guy that would always stay at friends' houses. So, you know, 2 or 3 days at one friend, 2 or 3 days the other friend, because my mom was always at work. So it was either I was going to be by myself at the apartment, or I would stay at my friends and just enjoy like being with my friends, playing outside or sports, you know, going. I was in 7-on-7 football. I did football year round, right? But essentially, you know, while I was working and doing all of that, that's what got me into the construction and development industry.
Tell us about that. What inspired you about that initially?
So I saw how lucrative and easy it was to basically grow a company if you had the right resources, right? So I had the knowledge of like the utility underground development.
How do you have the knowledge at the time?
From, you know, working at the quarry in high school.
Yeah, tobacco
drivers. So I was seeing like, okay, like what's going on with all this gravel and topsoil and refill? Like, where's this all going on? It goes to big, you know, subdivisions that they're creating and developing or raising the land for floodplains, things like that. I was like, okay, cool. I was like, huh, I wonder if there's like a college degree that focuses on this. And I did research. And thankfully, you know, my roommate, my freshman year in college, Austin Roberts, he was like, hey, I'm studying construction engineering. Like, you know, with your background, it seems like this is something lucrative for you. You should check it out. And I was like, okay, like, you know, why not? Applied for the program, got in, focused on that. And as soon as I got in, I got an internship. Thankfully, his parents were really connected to this big general contractor in the Valley. And he was like, they have an office in San Antonio. Like, you should look into interning. Interned under an assistant project manager, Joe Vella. He taught me a lot based off of like being a PM, you know, budgeting, you know, calling subcontractors and scheduling. And that's when I was like, okay, like I know what I want to do, right? I want to be in the, you know, contracting space for a little bit. And that's what I focused on throughout college. And, you know, I met, you know, my best friend in the fraternity, Matthew. I kind of told them my vision that I've always wanted to be a developer. I've always been fascinated with buildings.
What is fascinating about it?
I don't know. Just like, I mean, since I was a kid, I would love to take things apart and putting them back together just to see how they operate. And I think that's how I kind of portrayed the buildings, right? It's like, okay, like, how do you go look at this property and build like this big building? Like, how does this come about, right? Like, and you know, at first I was like, it's just, you know, you can buy any piece of property as long as it fits, you know, it goes in. But there's a lot more that goes behind that, right? And that's what I was learning throughout my college and, you know, after college. And that's what I started focusing on. And I went and worked for a big GC company at NASA. I was a Building 21 and I was a field engineer there. Learned so much. I had a lot of responsibility and I'm glad, like, you know, I became a lead field engineer after 6 months, our lead field engineer before that was transferred to another project. And I got to learn so much. And I was like, okay, like, I think I've learned a lot and enough that I want to go out on my own probably in the next 1 or 2 years.
And how old were you at the time? Wasn't that scary thought?
I was 21, 22. Yeah.
Well, you always knew that, or that was just so natural?
I've always known I wanted to be an entrepreneur.
Why?
The autonomy that you have, the freedom, and, like, you know, the not having so much, like, family time growing up, especially, like, just with my mom. And I wanted to be able to have more family time after, like, creating my base, right? So, obviously, anyone can just go the regular route, make a salary, and just go the corporate structure, and nothing wrong with that. You know, if I didn't have, you know, the risk in me to go and make that leap, I would have done that. But I was more of an entrepreneur. I've always I've always been that way. I've always been, like, curious. And, you know, I thought, I was like, if I made it this far already, like, if I fail, I can just go back to there. I'm never going to go back all the way to the bottom. It's going to be, you know, where you left off. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like you don't have any experience. Like, you know, I work there, and and I gained this experience and knowledge that, you know, somebody's going to take me and get back to where I was before, right? But taking these leaps, right? So
how's it happen? Is it easy, or how do you make that jump?
It was not easy. So me and a partner started a construction company. We were not aligned in what we really wanted to do, whether we wanted to focus on small projects or, like, remodels or, like, big projects, right? But obviously, with not that much experience, a lot of these big developers are not going to hire you because, you know, it's a risk, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want the job to fail or to cost more. Like, you didn't foresee things that were having contingencies in place. And we're like, okay, let's start with small projects and stuff. But we just weren't getting enough traction. I think a lot of it had to be the age issue. Like, our whole life, especially now, like, there's a lot of pushback because of our age. When you're dealing with these big developers or big bankers, you know, there's always going to be pushback because of the age difference. And, like, they kind of are, like, more risk averse and, like, okay, like, how does this guy know so much? Like, is he telling the truth? Things like that, right? So we started the company. We got, like, 2 or 3 projects. It didn't go so well. Obviously, it was a learning curve. We either broke even or lost money. Again, we went back and we're like, hey, let's go back to the drawing board. Let's get more experience. So he went to go focus on some other venture, and I went to go work for a large residential developer.
How long was that time for you? 6 months?
That was about 6 to 8 months.
Was it a tough decision to make, say, let's go by the drawing board? That sounds...
Yeah, I mean, we have to. It's those decisions you have to make, right? Like, thankfully, I created myself a base. I'd paid off my college loans, you know, with my first, you know, salary job at the NASA project. And, you know, I was like, okay, like, I have some, you know, some savings that I can basically tap into, you know, throughout the time that I'm trying to figure out what to do. Like, do we start another company? Do we focus elsewhere? Or let's go save some more money and gain more experience, right? So we both did that.
But Jimmy, how are you able to so objectively looking at this and not let the ego of, you know, like, you know, involve, say, oh, that's our business, that, you know, you want to make it work. But you're able to just look at the facts, say, well, okay, this did not work. Let's try something else. Like, how would you able to be so logic and, like, very objective approach this?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with, like, you know, like I said, growing up the way that I did is, like, always having to be able to be objective, open-minded, reading the room. Like, you know, a lot of reading and just seeing how other people do it, right? Getting mentorship, you know. I went back to my initial internship, you know, project manager, Joe Vella. I was like, hey, like, what did you do, you know, like, to get to where you are and things like that? And I started talking to multiple people. I got some mentors, you know, like Jeff Houston. Like, he told me about it's very important to find your first partner and, like, it's, you know, things like that. And he allowed me to live with him when I was doing these transitions. So thankfully, like, he was supporting me and, you know, keeping a roof over my head. So I was able to do that and still help out my family back home. At, you know, at the time, my stepdad wasn't in the picture yet. You know, just being logical, it's like, okay, like, not every business is successful the first time. I mean, you hear these big, you know, wealthy individuals were like, you know, talking about, like, oh, businesses are not going to go the way that you want because you can write something. You can, like, I tell everybody this, right? I have a lot of friends who are always like, hey, like, I want to do this, but I want to, like, organize myself and plan everything accordingly before I jump in. I'm like, nothing's going to go according to plan. Never. It never does. And I'm giving it to you from experience. It's not going to go the way. You have to go get that experience hands on, you're going to fail or things are not going to go your way. But step back, fix them. Those are learning experiences, and people see them as more like negatives, but they're not. They're learning experiences. So
do you always this positive looking at failure? Because it's not the easy thing to do, Jamie.
Yeah, it's not. And I never see it as a failure. Like, you know, I've always very, you know, positive and optimistic, you know, because things are never going to go your way. And you just have to, it's like, you know, what they always say is like, it doesn't matter when or how you fall, it's how fast and how you get up and look at things, right? Like, are you going to fight back? Are you going to push back? Or are you just going to let yourself stay on the ground? You know, things like that.
I love that perspective. I think it's all about expectation management. If you expect nothing going to go your way, and if anything goes your way, well, expectation and reality, you're going to be happy. But if you expect everything going to be perfect and other way it doesn't, you're going to feel a lot disappointed.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, everybody goes into starting a business wanting to be rich or wealthy. And it's not the way that you should look at it. Like, you know.
Well, how do you look at it?
I look at it as an autonomy and a freedom, right? Like, you're doing something that you love. So you're never working a day in your life, essentially, right? Everybody says, right? I know it's very...
But that's true. As cliche it is, it is true.
It is. And like for example, last night, right? I know Matt and I were up till 1:30 in the morning and, you know, probably went to sleep at 2:30 to prepare and come here from Houston. And like, I'm fine. If it was doing it for somebody else and working at a corporation, I would have been stressed, upset, frustrated, you know? And this is the things that you have to trade for. It's like, yes, you're working 12 hours a day when you start out, but you're doing it for yourself.
It's
and
it's
like
you want.
Eat what you kill, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like you want more projects. You have to network and you have to meet more people and you have to stay up longer. You know, like that's what it is. And you know, I've gotten myself used to sleeping 4 to 6 hours a night. You know,
you're hustling, Jimmy.
That's incredible. And that's what it is, right? But it's because I want to create a base now that I'm young. I'm young enough to take these risks and fail, because if I fail, I don't have a family that I need to support myself, right? Mm-hmm. I want to take care of my mom and my siblings, but like, I'm really thankful that my stepdad came into the picture and he allowed me to basically, he's like, hey, don't worry. I'm going to take care of the family. You focus on yourself, focus on your career. Mm. I was like, okay, cool. I'm making all these risks, but they've always believed in me. My mom has never questioned me once. She's like, your grades are there. I support you. Whatever you want to do, just stay away from trouble. And, I know you're going to be fine. I know you're going to be fine. So
that's her support mean a lot to you.
100%. And her support was more loving than it was financial, right? Like, she would do anything for me to get what I want. Mm-hmm. But obviously, like, growing up, I knew that we were limited. Like, I'm not always going to get what I want, you know? So that's kind of like where I started getting that mentality. It's like, not the things that you want are always not going to come about, right? Like, you need to work for them. And there's things like you can plan for them. Do whatever it takes. If you really want it, you're going to get it, right?
You have such a great value, Jimmy. I felt you are truly not only a true hardworking, true, let's call it American dream, that person, but also you have such a great value regarding who you are and how life should show up for you.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, I think everybody should view it that way, right? It's like a lot of people are always like upset at their jobs or sad, or you can just see them, you know, just burning them to the ground. And you know, they're going to stay there until it's their last breath. And sometimes people make financial decisions, you know, early on where, you know, they get their first job and they want to go get a house, the nice car and things like that. But you have to give that stuff up, right? Like, you know, when we started our real estate fund, you know, like I wasn't paying myself for the first 2 to 3 years. And it's like, you have to take those risks. And
tell us more about that, by the way. And what happened after you all moved forward from the first business?
Yeah, so from the first business, basically, I went to go work as a project manager at a residential development company called William Lyon Homes. It was before RSI Communities, and I was very thankful for one of my colleagues, Sean Holmes. He, you know, submitted my resume to his superior, and Ryan. And Ryan has been very helpful in the development side as well, like when we started out, like what to look for and things like that. But went there, worked there for a year and a half, but I had told them that I think that now I've gotten more insight in what the pre-development like entails. I want to go to law school. So essentially, I got all the experience that I needed, because everybody thinks that because they can build, you know, or learn how to build a commercial building, right? Like, you know, 200,000 to 500,000 square foot building. It's the same. Like, you can build anything, right? A house. Essentially, you can, but it's a lot more fast paced. So when you go from building a building to a home, it's a lot more fast paced. So once I went to the residential development, we were doing about 120 houses per year. And wow. You do that math, you know, it's like 10 to 15 homes a month. Some months you have to do more, right? And obviously you're on a bonus structure. So the earlier you finish them, you get a higher bonus, things like that, right? So we're incentivized working hard. But at the time I was studying for the LSAT. So I moved from Houston to Austin and I was working.
Why do you want to go to law school? That's so, how your business doing well, career doing well.
So because I knew that I was going to be an entrepreneur, I wanted to protect myself and the people that I'm working with. I wanted to be able to review partnership agreements, contracts. You know, I knew I was not going to be a litigator. I wanted to focus on the transactional side.
Mm.
So, you know, while I was there, got studied for the LSAT, went to law school, went to U of H.
Congratulations.
And thank you. And
that was not easy.
It was not. It was not. Very competitive and very smart colleagues. There's like, you know, you think that you know something, especially you raise your hand and you speak, and then the professor's by like, good, but no, right? Like, there's always different. I had the engineering mindset, right? It's like, this is the formula, this is the problem, this is the answer. Mm. And law, it's like, yes, but also this, right? There's different arguments. It's like when it
depends.
Yeah, always, exactly. It depends. That's the biggest answer. Like, it depends. Yeah. If you see it this way, like, are you in the defense side? Are you on the offense side, right? Like, who are you representing? You're always going to have to flip. Those are the loopholes and things that I started to learn. Like, law school teaches you what to look for, like how to be a lawyer. But the actual practice when you're out on the field is like, okay, like that is all the value and experience that you're gaining. And, you know, I interned at, you know, the DA's office at the major offender division. And I was, you know, looking at very neat things like, you know, capital murder cases and things like that. And, you know, death penalty cases and very, very like mind-blowing open-mindedness and, you know, like the people that I was working for, you know, the things that they're giving up and like to see these things, like it sucks the soul out of you. So I was like, okay, like I know I don't want to be a litigator, but it's good experience on your resume. And like everybody knows that when you're a prosecutor, you have so much value, so much trust, you know, like I really respect those people. But then I was like, okay, well, if I want to do transaction, I need to go like get another opportunity in more corporate. So I got an opportunity to work at Baker Hughes in-house counsel under the M&A division. And that's when the whole GE and Baker Hughes merger was happening. So I got to actually experience and be involved in that.
Oh, wow.
And how it was basically merged so that the stock price can like increase and then there's going to split the dividends, you know, things like that. So I was learning all of these things along the way, like reviewing very, very extrinsic, you know, operating agreements, business structure, tax, you know, like structures, everything, like because I was in the Latin American and U.S. Areas. So got that experience. And then I got an opportunity to work at the SEC. And at the SEC, it was, you know, it goes from public.
SEC?
Yeah, the Securities and Exchange Commission. I was a legal honors and intern. So I was in the corporation finance division and I was learning a lot on the other side, right? Like what is the government? What is the SEC looking for from a public company when you're doing, you know, initial public offerings and when there's a merger and acquisition, like what are the steps that it takes to get there? What are they looking for? Like reviewing the documents, making sure that there's no.
So what are they looking for? Enlighten us a little bit more.
Well, there's a lot of financial model reviewing, making sure that there's no insider like information being released. Making sure that, you know, the public is being protected, the investors are being protected. So it's kind of like that gave me the experience of like how to protect our investors when we started our company, right?
Yeah.
So how you need to go and like submit these registrations, are you exempt? Like trying to get away from this SEC stuff is just not a go. Like, you know, they catch you, you know, essentially you can create an amazing company. And if you're not registered, if you don't do it correctly with the SEC, you don't do those things, you're basically stop from transferring those to a sell, right? So I can't sell that business to another business. So like as a roll up, unless they're registered because you didn't register them. So they don't know who invested, what was invested and like nobody's really protected. So there's all these measures that are in place to protect the public, protect investors and things like that. And I would have known none of that, you know, starting out right now, I would have been doing things just like, hey, like, you know, under the table.
So now you are drastically two kind of different career. Throughout this journey, were you always thinking you're going to go back to an entrepreneur as that intention or more like, let's see how things go?
100%. So After the SEC, you know, after finishing law school, I went to work at a real estate and M&A boutique, right? A smaller law firm, but they had amazing big clients. And, you know, very thankful for the opportunity. It was Stevenson Fournier. And I was very astonished into, like, the whole, like, you know, when I was in the real estate side with them, I was getting a lot of knowledge on, like, what they're looking for, what clauses we need to push back on, what things they want in an agreement on the buyer versus the seller side, you know, purchase agreements and, you know, data rooms and what to look for in a data room if you're focusing on the corporate, like, merger side. I learned so much there, and I was like, okay, I think I've learned enough for me to go and do this again. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I need to talk to my best friend. And that's kind of when we started getting together. Like, Matt was getting a lot of experience in investment banking mm-hmm. and private equity. And I was like, hey, you know what I realized? There's this niche between banks, Wall Street, and development and construction. They always third party that, right? It's like you're getting a bank to lend you money as a developer, but you're outsourcing the construction. Why don't we just merge all of it together? You know, that's like kind of the structure I was thinking. I'm like, I know the construction and development side. You know how to raise capital. Let's merge it.
One thing.
Yeah, let's merge it to one thing. And
what's the benefit of that?
So there's a lot of premiums that you save, right? So instead of, like, for example, like, I'm a developer. I want to develop this building. Mm-hmm. I go to the investor. I'm like, hey, I want to make a deal, you know, building this building, and then we're going to rent it out, right, for 5 years, whatever. Well, a lot of the people are not as risky to want to develop it because they don't do as much due diligence as we do because of our experience, right? They just kind of like, I would rather buy a building that is already existing and we remodel it, right? Maybe like a distressed property or somewhere where a location where it's like, you know, it's going to explode in the next few years. So they do the BRRRR method, right? And that is essentially you buy, you remodel, you refinance, and then you rent. The refinance used for another building and do it again, right? So although that's good and it's very, very, you know, risk-free, the premiums are not there, right? Like what you're making profit-wise. So I was like, let's change it. Why don't we do ground up? So when you get a development idea, right? Like, okay, like let's go look at this property. What fits, right? So when we started with residential, like what fits? Okay, 10 houses fit here. Awesome. What are we going to do for the GC, right? If we outsource the GC, we're already losing, you know, $20,000 to $30,000 per house on the GC, just the cost. I was like, let's in-house that. Instead, let's hire a construction manager to work under us. So it's like we're running a construction company and a development company separately. On the model, you put it that way. It's like the GC fee, but it's coming back, and it goes back to profits, right? Mm-hmm. Developer puts a certain amount of – and you also need less income, like less investment to go pull out a land to construction loan. Mm-hmm. So you get the land to construction loan with the investment money, and you're paying for the GC fee and the construction cost of material and labor. And after that, once you develop everything, you have a huge, you know, fluff that you can't lose unless it's like the market just goes back to 2008 levels, right? Yes, there's a risk that the houses will sell slower, but there's so much bluff that the timing doesn't really matter. So it's like, and the investors love it, right? It's like, yeah, usually when I'm investing in a real estate, it's you're investing in a building and then you're not going to get your money back until 5, 6, 7, 10 years. Our returns are in 2 years, within 2 years.
Why is 5 years versus 2 years? I know you are doing it faster, but you just say the timing does not matter.
Correct. But because we go to another project and you're getting a higher return in a shorter amount of time.
Okay.
So,
but conventionally it's 5 to 10 years?
Conventionally, if you're buying a building, since you're buying into the premium. So if I built this building for, let's say, $1 million.
Okay.
That's what it costs for me to develop and build. Mm-hmm. As soon as I'm done with it, the city and appraisals are going to appraise this building at maybe $1.3, $1.4 million. Mm-hmm. So there's a $300,000 to $400,000 premium.
Correct.
That you can make just by selling the building.
Right.
Well, instead, we can just refinance the building, still get the $300,000 to $400,000, do it again, and the investors can get their money right away. Mm-hmm. Or they can hold and get rental income. Mm-hmm. And you structure the deal different ways, right? Like instead of doing like a 50-50, you do 80-20, 70-30. And we also have more managerial control, right? Mm-hmm. We own and we develop the building. So I've always been astonished about like development because of the premiums that are able to be gained by doing the ground up. Mm-hmm. Not saying there's anything wrong with buying an existing building. It's the safest way it's been going. Mm-hmm. That's the traditional way. But if you get the backing from, you know, the investors and our connections that we've created, especially Matt, you know, being in the Northeast on Wall Street, like, they don't see these types of returns over there unless you're like in private equity and investing in those.
What are the return we're talking about, by the way?
So we average a 25 to 30% IRR.
That's
to our
insane.
Investors. Yeah, and that's triple to almost quadruple the market right now in real estate. And that's because of the premiums that we're creating along the way from merging all of that. So that's kind of how we came up with all of that. And, you know, taking back to the experience, it's kind of like in law school, in the real estate law firm I was at, I was seeing these agreements and what they were giving in returns and what they were doing. And yes, it was an amazing model.
What's their return?
Theirs were about 15 to 22.
Got it. Wow.
But again, it's a private equity firm. So it's like for you to get in there, it's already hard enough. You have to have a minimum, right? So smaller PE firms may require, you know, $1 to $2 million, where these big PE firms require tens of millions of dollars. By the time I'm able to invest in one of those, and then when you do invest in one of those, your money's stuck for 7 to 10 years. And you don't even know what's going on, right?
Yeah.
Because they get an equity, they get an upside that you don't know what it is. So you might make 100% on that money, but the PE firm is keeping that and keeping you at the 20 that they told you and promised you that they're going to get you. So it's like, let's stop that, like, and let's kind of protect our investors and show them and be more transparent. And that's how you keep the investors to stay long term. You know, our investors, the first time for the first deal, are rolling their money into the next deal. They don't want it back because how good the returns are getting, right? They're making more money from a 401k and things like that. So that's how you keep that relationship. And, you know, as being transparent, yeah, there's downfalls. Sometimes it takes longer. Sometimes weather, you know, you just can't foresee those things, but they're still happy, you know.
And that's 100% investor roll their investment to the next one?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. They're just very interested in the way our structure is. It's different because, again, like, they have opportunities to invest, but it's riskier, right? And we show them how much due diligence we work. Like, for us to do a deal, it takes us, like, 6 to 8 months, you know, to do due diligence, to make sure, you know, engineering's like green lighted everything, like making sure that the utilities are there, and like you need to know how to really read and understand the property. Like, everybody thinks that, oh, look, there's this property right next to this apartment. Why don't they just build this there? It needs it. Well, maybe you can't. Maybe there's restrictions, there's conditions, there's covenants, or, you know, maybe there's zoning issues. Like, who knows, right? But that's the research that we do before. So we waste our own money doing this research before going to our investors and saying, hey, this is a good deal.
Yeah.
We don't go to our investors and say, hey, this looks like a good deal. Invest this much and let's hope we can do it. No, it's more like, we know we can do it. We've already got green lighted from everybody that we need. If we do it, this is the way that it would work. And that's why, you know, Matt calls it the European menu. It's like, what you see in there is what you get. And even if, like, the returns on the end are not the same because of all that bluff, we can just decrease our liquid and give it to our investors as promised in the agreement. So things like that. So,
do you feel like you are at your genius zone? Do you feel like you do exactly what you're meant to do, Jimmy?
I think so. I think I've always been very personable. I think I've met so many people along the way, just networking, and a lot of people just ask me for advice. They send me a lot of deals, and I love including people in the deals, right? And like, hey, like, you know, if you get me this deal, I'm going to let you in on this or on this. And like, giving back and like helping also teaches me more, right? Because I'm never going to push back. It's like, oh, I know everything. I'm never going to be that way. But I'm always willing to learn, always, you know, there's always going to be the next big thing, a next new thing that, you know, maybe we haven't realized, but I'm still learning. I'm going to continue to learn and find new ways to structure different things.
Yeah.
And I think that this is kind of where I was destined to be, and I love it.
Wow. Wow. That's a big statement. What do you think is your biggest learning along the way is your second entrepreneur effort?
I would say being able to understand others, right? Like, just because we think that a deal is going to be amazing, the bank may not. The investors may not. You know, they have...
Lying everybody.
Yeah, there's... like, you have to think about, like, how many things come out on the news or on social media about, like, oh, this is happening to real estate, this happened to real estate. Ignore the white noise. Focus and be confident in what you're doing. It's kind of like what I've learned. It's kind of like, hey, like, you ignore the white noise, you're going to be okay. Like, you didn't get this far by guessing or hoping, you know. Like, yeah, I would say a lot of luck is involved, you know, things that happen, like, you know, the pandemic was a horrible thing that happened, but that's what got us the opportunity to do and start what we're doing now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I love it.
What do you think is your superpower, Jimmy?
I think being very diligent, determined, being able to read people very well, just reading the room and understanding like who to basically like get into bed with when it comes to like business, just because there's a lot of people who are going to push back or they're going to try to like put things in your head. And that's kind of things that me and, you know, Matt talk about a lot. It's kind of like, hey, like, I know that he said this, but like, don't worry about it, right? Like, we did 8 months of due diligence and they saw this for 2 days, you know, this weekend, and they're telling us all of this. So like, you know how to like push that back. You know, there's risks. I'm not saying it's always going to be, you know, positive. There's going to be risks, but we need to know how to mitigate and manage those risks.
You mean people are going to put potential fear in your mind and you have discerned what works, what doesn't work, and still focus and let go of those white noise.
Exactly. Because yes, that stuff can happen, but we've already included those measures to mitigate and manage, right? That can happen. They're not wrong, but we've put things in place to make sure that they're mitigated and managed.
I love that. What do you think is a thing that you want left on this planet? One day, if we're all long gone, what do you want your capstone say about you?
I would say it would be something about like changing the way things are structured and made in regards to, you know, business and helping others get away from the greed. There's enough business, there's enough money, there's enough, you know, opportunities out there for everybody. I think that, you know, as long as you focus on your passion, whatever that is, you know, whether it's art, you know, cooking food, you know, we met this amazing person, Daniel Cachot. He is an amazing chef and hasn't had his opportunity to show the world what he's about, right? You know, he's a private chef right now for people here in Austin, but we're giving him an opportunity to do our concept, you know, Muzzy's Bagels.
Yes. Yeah.
And the way he's changed the game in R&D, you know, the way you make a bagel, it's not your typical New York style bagel. He's infusing, you know, like Italian flours, Australian flours.
Wow.
To like create the different time. He's still R&D right now, but the way you see how passionate, like that's an art. That's somebody, like, some people are not allowed that opportunity, right? Because they're so stuck into what they're doing. And that's what I want, like to be known as a person that helped others, like get away from the greed. It's not always about the money.
Yeah, what is it about for you, Jimmy?
It's about giving people the opportunity to follow their dreams. I think, you know, I wasn't given the benefit and opportunity to, you know, have a financial support growing up. So I had to create my own path there. But
do you think that's a strength? Do you think that's has become an opportunity for you?
Yes, it has, because I've, you know, Matt and I have bootstrapped, you know, we've bootstrapped a lot of, you know, the business and stuff like that and helped each other out with everything and learning to work harder. And when you create, you know, it's like you can't compare to raising a baby, right? And I don't know what that is, but it's like your baby. The business is your baby. Like, you raise it how you want. And once it grows up and you want it to be so successful, like, you need to know how, like, to let it walk on its own legs, right? So I think like that, just being able to keep it afloat, keep it running and getting it successful, and then being able to back off from it and letting other people start, like, figuring out their dreams and their passions. I think, like, I love that. It's like, I'm very passionate about just helping others, just because I didn't have those opportunities. I want to give it back.
That's incredible. I can definitely see how all that passion that you have built and really build into momentum for the business, but also more importantly, helping the people, the community, which is really impactful.
Yeah.
So what's next for you, Jimmy?
So right now we've been putting a lot of our focus into this, you know, traditional fund that Matt and I created. It's focusing more on what we just spoke about, which is
construction.
Helping people follow their passions, right? Like, we're creating this community where our investors are investing, but if they have an opportunity or they have an idea, like, hey, like, I saw this business, I think it can do really well if you do it here or do it there. So, okay, like, let's run the model. Like, we'll do all this work up front, and if it works out, we'll go raise capital for it. And then you can be in the GP mix, you know, with the general partner with us, and you can run the company with us, like, if you know how to run it, things like that. Like, giving those opportunities to kind of like get people out of where they're stuck and follow what they really want to do, right? Like, it doesn't matter how small. Like, Bagels isn't attractive. Like, it's not a tech company, right? But there's people that love it and passionate, like Daniel, who are very passionate and like creating his baby to make this happen. And then after that, he can get his name out there and then start his actual concept that he wants to do. So I think that focusing on that and creating more like business, you know, ideas with our investors and things like that, just helping people out, just continue to grow and see where it takes us.
I love that. I love what you said about it's never just about whether it's an idea or a bagel or whatever you call it. It's about we all here sharing our gift, sharing what we meant to do on this planet, whether it's creating a beautiful bagel or build these amazing houses or create this, you know, bomb.com restaurant that, you know, we all love and go. And I think when we all share our gift, when we all doing our best, this is how we made the world a better place.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's the same thing in the construction side, right? Like, I've met so many subcontractors who are working for somebody, right? Like, they're very skilled in the labor that they do, whether it's electrical or framing or plumbing. Mm-hmm. They're so good at it. But because they have the, you know, immigrant disadvantage, you know, they're like, they feel stuck. And I'm like, you know, you can create, you know, I help them like, hey, you know, you can create a company because all you need is an EIN and you can start your own and bring your people. Like, that way you're not like, you know, they talk about me like, oh, my boss doesn't pay me on time, like things like that. And like, I help them out, you know, that's where like kind of my law side comes in. I'm like, you know, you can create this and start your own company and go get other job. You don't need them. Like, I'll help you out, you know, things like that. And like, I like to help people and I speak Spanish fluently. You know, that was my first language. And I get along with these guys a lot and they help me in the long run. You know, they give me better prices and things like that. Like, they know I'm doing well, but they still don't, you know, try to take advantage of me when it comes to pricing on the apron. When it comes to construction, it's all about how much you're paying per square foot, right? Like, if I can save 25 cents, a lot of people are like, oh, that's nothing, just pay it. Like, no, it's a lot when you're building 20 to 50 houses. You're multiplying that by 2,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. It's quite a bit of money. It adds up to, you know, that would be 20 to 30 grand, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like, put that back in your mind. If you're doing 10 projects, that's $300,000 that you're saving on 25 cents.
Yeah.
You know, like, people don't see it that way, and that's how you need to see it. It's all about the pennies, right? Like, and people don't. So if I'm got 25 cent discount from one of my framers because I was nice to him and I helped him on the side by, you know, trying to like get away from his boss, I'm going to help him out.
You're like a great businessman. But in the meantime, such a heart forward community leader as well. You speak about people are feeling stuck. Why is that?
I think a lot of the time it's they haven't found what they really want to do. Or they're trying to do what they do, but maybe it's like very liquid heavy requirement. You know, they probably need a lot of money, or maybe they, you know, unfortunately, you know, the way that the structure is now, it's like it's so easy to pull out school loans, student loans, but you can't go pull out a business loan. It takes years of you to have backing liquid, but you can pull out a student loan like this. Right? So whenever, like, you know, we took out our first loan, like, we needed a lot of backing. We were both making good salaries and stuff. Even then, we still got pushed back. Raising the initial amount of capital, right? Like, you know, when we first raised our first $100,000, it was hard.
And tell us about that process.
Yeah. So, I mean, thankfully, you know, Matt, he is a family member, Cedric Suarez, you know, he was talking to us, and he's always been very supportive in what we want to do. We've always told him his ideas. He's like, oh, that's like, you should go for it, like, you know, take those risks and stuff. And we told him, like, hey, we have this business opportunity for the first development. We need 100 grand for these houses. He's like, okay, like, what will that get me, blah, blah, blah. So told him the structure and everything. He's like, I trust you guys. I think you guys are gonna do amazing. You guys have always worked really hard and done what you say you're gonna do.
Yeah,
I'm gonna trust you guys, give it to us. And then from then started being able to raise more capital. It's always the first, you know, what they say. A lot of people say it's hard to make your first million, but it's also hard to raise your first 100. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people out there with wealth, but you need to trust you. And like, again, I think a lot of it had to do with our backgrounds. Like, Matt was already on Wall Street and things like that. And I was in law and like I had a construction background. So that also gave them a lot of trust. And I think that's another benefit of doing what I did.
People factor.
Exactly. And, It was that, right? So once we started that, projects finished, and then going to the next one. Same people want to roll their money in because the returns are amazing. So now it's easier to raise money. You know, it took us, I would say, about a month to raise close to $1 million. When before it took us 6 months to raise $100,000.
How do you do that? Do you call people? Do you email people? Do you DM?
It's the networking, right? So it's the people that have been, you know, whenever we first reached out to our first set, you know, of investor lists, you know, Matt's connections mostly on Wall Street that he's created from working with these colleagues from, you know, first year investment banking associates to, you know, private equity. He's learned a lot, and I've met a lot of these people because I was visiting Matt in New York a lot. And after we had created these relationships, especially me in law too, I had a lot of relationship with a lot of people that I know would invest. And we reached out to a couple, and they were so early in their career that they're like, I don't have that much liquid yet, but give me 2 to 3 years and, you know, I'll invest. And thankfully for our developments, we can take minimums of 25 to 50 grand.
Oh.
And a lot of these big firms won't take that. You know, it's micro investing and they don't take that, but we do it and we give you an amazing return. And we want our friends to have those opportunities, and we know that they're going to stay for the long run. Like, you know, so we structure these different things where it's tax incentives and things like that, where they just keep their money and keep rolling it, you know, do 1031 exchanges and things like that. And it's very beneficial. So we kind of just call them, update them how everything's doing, and we're like, hey, we're coming up with this new opportunity. We think we're going to start raising capital in about 1 or 2 months. We would need it at this month, right? Like at X month. They're like, okay, like, let me move some things around and let me let you know how much I can invest. Some people invest 25, some people invest 100. Some people invest 100, and then they go see the property, look at what's going on, and see, like, what we put on our investor deck. We show them what's there, but then when they go actually see it, they're like, hey, can I give you 300 instead? Mm. You know, so there's things like that where they're like, oh, they're actually seeing what's going on, and they see what we saw before, and like, they're like, okay, awesome. And that's a lot that it takes, like, me being able to do the due diligence, you know, with Matt before, you know, hey, like, these permits were just approved, right? Like, they're building these retail shopping centers like a block away. So there's gonna be a need for this. There's gonna be a need for that. Like, thinking outside the box, forecasting these things. So, okay, like, why do you want to build that instead of that? Well, look what's going on over there. It's not built yet, but the permits are public information. So you look at the permits, like, oh, it just got approved. And that's it. Like, you get to know those things. Just the same way where people look for distressed properties or people look for liens to take over. That way, you know, whoever owns the houses and getting kicked out by, you know, taxes and stuff like that, like, they go take over and give them a good price and they sell it, you know, things like that. We do it differently with the permitting, right? Like, it's like, you look at a permit, it's been approved, this is what they're going to build. Let's copy that. Let's do another one over here. There's something going on there. Some people follow the Starbucks method, right? Like, wherever there's Starbucks, there's going to be a lot of development going on. Some people follow CityQuest and NewQuest, and they're like, okay, if they're buying property there, then I should too, right? We do the same thing in a way with permits. So just the way that
you're such a visionary. I can see that you love to solve puzzles. You love to see different crews and then piece them together. Yeah. And with that beautiful vision, you can invite your community, your friends, your people, your investor, come join you in this masterpiece.
Yeah. And it's not like me knowing everything, right? It's things that I learned along the way. But the network that I've created growing up, right? Being personable, being nice to people, like, you know, Ryan, for example, the my boss at, you know, RSI Communities, I called him when I first started. I was like, hey, if I'm buying a subdivision, if I want to build a subdivision, like, what are the things I need to look for? And this was like while I was in law school, so I didn't really learn like title review and things like that. He's like, floodplain issues, any restrictions, things like the things that I kind of had an idea about already. So, okay, cool. So I started focusing my time on, and like, while I was in law school and that, and then my internship, and then when I was at the real estate law firm. Mm. So that's where I started being like, okay, I can do this on my own. Like, I can read the title commitments from the last purchase, seeing if there's any, you know, restrictions. If, you know, there was a restriction in one of our San Antonio projects. Mm. And basically it had it to where it was, you could only build one house on every 4 acres. Okay. And there was 12 acres. So it's 4 houses max that you can build. So like, okay, like, how can we remove the restriction? The restrictions were put in place from a trust back in like the 70s or 80s. So all we had to do is get a signature of the current owner to, you know, waive that. And we were able to do that. And like, things to like, that's what in the law it taught me. Like, you can just reach out, get it waived off. We were able to switch that to 15 houses.
Wow.
So you're getting the lot at the same price, but now building 15 instead of 4, right? Yes, you're building smaller houses, but for the area, it's very lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
But things like that, right? Like, things that you learn along the way to, you know, do the things that you want and keep networking and always reach out to people. Like, you know, if you need help, like, yes, there's Google and stuff, but get it from somebody that has the experience. And I think it's very useful.
I found most amazing about you, Jimmy, is you're not only a visionary who are able to see something from nothing. You also are very grounded in your approach, whether it's from different skills and classes, and you are very intentional about things you need to learn, so then you actually apply those things. The reason I say that is because I believe there are three types of person on this planet. And again, very, very generalizing. Let's call it like a three triangle, for example. Yeah. On top here, you got the visionary who are someone like you who love to see incredible magic from nothing. That person, let's call it really like Steve Jobs of the world. And then you also have, I call it operational geniuses. He or she can see, wow, you want to go to the moon? No problem, Jimmy. We got three steps. One, two, three, boom, we got to the moon. And then you have third person on the left, I call it say marketing specialist. He or she is able to take this idea, take his vision, now share and broadcast to the world. Mm-hmm. In other words, this three triangle, generally speaking, a person say, let's go to the moon. And this operational genius say, no problem, let's build three steps. And this person over here say, wow, this is amazing. Let's share this with the entire world. And generally speaking, people usually one or another, but not really that well-rounded. But based on talking to you, Jimmy, I felt like you, maybe I'm guessing, you tell me what you think. I think you primarily are visionary at heart. You love solve puzzles. You are curious and innate. You love to figure it out. How's the best optimal way to create value and supporting people? Meanwhile, you also, that operational genius is in that metaphor speaking, that you are able to put a groundwork. You are actually grounded, knowing how to do step one, two, and three to make it happen. 100%. And meanwhile, you're also a people leader. You also can bring this vision and share with the entire people and share with them what you do and why this could be an incredible opportunity.
100%. I think that a lot of that comes from the way I grew up, having to figure things out on my own, because I couldn't rely on a friend of mine or somebody to be like, hey, like, help me catch a football the way you catch a football, right? It's going to be different for me. So I have to try it different ways, right? So I'm never going to give
because
up.
Because you are different. Yeah. So you cannot rely on people's. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
I can't give up on things just because maybe I have a disadvantage or there's a disadvantage. There's always going to be disadvantages on deals. There's always going to be disadvantages just on anything, right?
But you never complain.
You can't.
I love that about you.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, if you're going to go into something, go into it 110%. If you go into it and you already have like these risk measures in your mind and already like dissuading and you're getting like very pessimistic, that's when you fail. And I've been there and it's like, okay, I need to overcome that.
So how do you do that for yourself?
So unfortunately, growing up, you know, getting bullied and stuff like that, I overcame it by fighting back, being able to, you know, learn how to fight. It was mostly street fighting, right? But I had a friend that allowed me to, you know, his dad owned a boxing gym. So I was allowed to get these techniques going and stuff like that. But got really close to my friends who always backed me up and protected me. And like now instead of me focusing like, oh, who I need to stay away from, I don't want to be bullied in front of everybody, I just walk my path and let it go. Brush it off your shoulder. Focus. Focus on what matters. Like, you know, these are probably going to be the same people that ask you for advice in the future. You know, and that's what I look at it for. And it has happened, you know, people that bullied me in the past or has kind of been very distant from me because of my, you know, disadvantage and stuff have came back and, hey, like, I know you're doing these things, like, can you help me with this? And just because of the past and you have, you know, these things that happen to you because of them, like, it doesn't mean that you need to push them off or hold that grudge, you know. They may be useful to you.
How do you forgive so easily? I think that's the hardest thing in the world.
It is very hard. I mean, I do hold grudges to an extent.
We all do.
But it's not in a way where I don't want to be your friend or I don't want to. It's more of like, hey, well, you kind of bashed on our idea or bashed on this idea. So like, why do you want to come in now? Right. Why? Because you saw like you don't want to take the risk from the beginning when we told you those are going to be the returns or these are going to be, you know, the things that are going to happen. Now that you've seen them happen, now it's like less risky and you want it, but you want those same returns or that same structure. It just doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. And doesn't mean I don't want to go into business with you and something else. It doesn't mean that I don't want to be your friend. It just, you need to know how to separate business and friendship. And that's kind of how I am. And forgive, you know, like people are in different areas and stages of their life that their mindset is completely different than yours. So take it with a grain of salt and move on. Because at the end of the day, it's a little chip is not going to matter 10 to 20 years from now. Just keep focusing and grow your network, because you never know. If you hold that grudge and maybe you need them in the future, they're going to hold that grudge back. Like, oh, you didn't talk to me before. No, you got to be friendly, personable, just take it with a grain of salt.
Today, looking back, Jimmy, I wonder, do you see you this advantage up front? Do you think this is an advantage for you?
100%.
Do you wish anything different?
No, when I was younger, I was always like curious as to why, you know, why me, why this? But I think, you know, now it's more like I respect myself more, and I get like, you know, I've overcame so much, you know, like even just like typing when I was in law school, like the disadvantage that I had of like, because when you take tests, you're on a time constraint and you're competing with very smart people, and typing the most very, you know, good arguments is hard when, you know, you're limited, you have a disadvantage. But, you know, talking to people, you know, trying to see if you can get accommodations and getting support from peers, like, has been very useful. And never hold things in, just speak out. If you need help, you need help. And I think, like, that's helped me a lot. And just having a different mindset, right? Just going into things differently and, like, knowing, like, okay, it's helped me read the room a lot, right? Like, you know, growing up, I would go to a group setting with a bunch of friends and stuff. I'm like, oh, I want to stay away from him because he's always asking questions. He's always really curious. And I don't want to be, like, the center of attention here. So I kind of back up, keep my hand in my pocket. Like, okay, don't ask. And I knew once they started getting too curious, I'd be like, hey, get to the side. Like, let's talk. And I'd tell them everything, show them. And they're like, oh, that's awesome. And in high school, it was easier because I was publicized. So everybody knew, right? You know, everybody, you know, if you were an athlete or if you were popular in a sense of, you know, athleticism or just like always out, right? Just doing sports, meeting people from other schools and stuff. It was easy. Everybody knew. But when you transition into college or law school or like out there in the world, it's like I have to gauge things differently. I have to approach things differently, which is like, hey, let them see what you're doing first, and then they can like judge you after that once they really get to know you, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I view things now, like reading the room and just being very psychological about approaches with humans in general.
You know how to play game theory.
Yeah. I'd have to try it.
Yeah, that exactly is what you're saying with the nine business school. But regardless, Jimmy, wow, I'm just memorized by you and how you show up in life, how you so intentional, how you have with so much integrity to you and the value, and how you show up on this world, how you make world a better place by creating so much more value for the community, for the investor, for people around you, and see how you grit, how you grind, how you hustle, how do you to beat all the odds.
Yeah.
And really be that change we all want to see in the world, which is just such a bright light. I want to ask you one last question. You mentioned earlier in the beginning that you are, your family are from Mexican descendant. I'm curious, how do you see about American dream, given that you have a complete different life compared to maybe your parents or above? How do you see that for you?
So I'm very thankful with the way the whole structure and the system is here. It's so easy to start a business. I mean, at the outset, it looks so hard, right? There's franchise taxes that you need to keep up with. You know, you need to figure out how to structure the company and how to be protected. Lawyers are expensive, but there's things in place, you know, that can help you start a business. There's a lot of knowledge out there. There's a lot of networking, a lot of people that can teach you or mentor you. And I think that if you get yourself out there, take the leap of faith, and you get those experiences, like, you're going to get an opportunity. Because again, if you fail, you're not going to go back to rock bottom. You're going to go midway or back to where you were before. So I kind of told Matt, what's the worst that can happen? If the business fails, pay our investors back, do it again. Maybe we didn't make any money, but we can get our jobs back, right? Like with the same girl, like, it's not a bad living, but there's so much advantage. There's so many jobs out there and there's so many opportunities, right? Like maybe the way that we did this the first time didn't work because of the specific business that we're in. Maybe we just focus instead of a niche or things like that. There's so much opportunity. And I think that anybody that's stuck or anybody that wants to, you know, take that leap and is just very, you know, skeptical about it, do it on the side. Start slow. Start it small. Keep your job. Keep it on the side. You have an 8 to 5, 8 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
You still have 5 to 6 hours
mm-hmm.
left over. Like, no, don't, like, yeah, spend time with some family. an hour with your family, charge your family. You still have 2 to 3 hours left. Go to the gym, an hour, 2 hours. You still have 1 hour left. Even 1 hour a day makes a difference. Mm. I do 1 hour a day just to study things that I know that I want to do on the side, like options trading, right? Like, I love options trading. It's like a game to me. But 1 hour a day, learning that, getting very, very good at it, and then, you know, when I'm prepared to go full on, I do that 1 or 2 hours a day. That's another source of income. I just like learning things like that the things that find me very, like, pique my interest, I'm going to try it out. You know, I'm always like that way. But there's so much opportunity here. And like I said, I take the leap of faith, ignore the white noise. That's the biggest one. You're going to get pushback no matter what. Mm. I can say I want to start, you know, a recording studio. And they're going to be like, oh, well, there's these negatives about it because, like, how are you going to rent them out? Like, how's this going to go? Okay, like, I've already figured that out. But don't push back. Don't say, like, oh, I already did that. Like, no, just let them talk and then write it down. Like, okay, those are concerns from other people. How do we switch that? How do we mitigate that? How is the advertising going to work? How's it work? Never push back. Ignore the white noise. Listen to it, but ignore it.
Never push back. That is a taste and courage.
Yeah.
To let ego aside, say, well, thank you.
Be the bigger person. Always be the bigger person. Mm. Yeah. And again, that comes back from being bullied, right? Mm. Growing up, it's like people are going to talk. Mm. People are going to push back. People are going to be negative about your ideas, your thoughts. Ignore it. You may be the next Amazon. You may be the next Tesla, SpaceX, you know?
Could be.
Exactly. So shoot for the stars. If you don't land in the stars, you'll land amongst the moon.
Oh, you know? Jimmy. So, you are definitely seeing my song. I love your attitude. You know what I think about when you say that? I think people like us have nothing to lose, and therefore you're able to play to win rather than people who are playing not to lose. I think it's a two different mentality.
100%.
And seeing you and really redefine what American dream is, really redefine the odds of adversity and still show up every single day with a positivity, with a big smile on your face and saying, being a big person. I think that really speaks so volume about who you are and how you win today.
Thank you very much.
So with that, Jimmy, what an honor. Thank you so much for being here. What an incredible journey. Thank you for being so authentic and share that with each and every one of us. I am so honored. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. We cannot wait to see you all next week. Bye, guys.